KaiserNetwork.org.
One of the things, ways of measuring the impact and power of our commitments. It is obviously wonderful to have $2.1 billion of commitments, but dollars alone can't measure the impact of what we're doing. And, for example, the commitments that are made in this area need to be measured in terms of metrics like greenhouse gas emissions avoided and more complicated measures of partnerships and impact. And it's a challenge, but we're working on other ways to convey the impact as well as dollars. If any of you are finalizing commitments or have a new commitment that you are you'd like to bring forward, please let us know. Talk to me, to Amy Christensen, to Michael Terrell. We'd like to make sure that you get recognition for what you're doing. Two program notes this morning. First, just a reminder, during the first part of each panel, the first 30 minutes, please give your table facilitators questions. They'll pass them along in the computer, and that way we can get questions to the panelists as soon as they go off the stage after the end of 30 minutes. Second, we had feedback yesterday from some, not from all, but from some, that they didn't want to sit with the same people all day long at their tables. Those were, yeah, anonymous comments at this point. So we're going to try an experiment this morning. We'll see how it works. We have two panels this morning, and it's punctuated by a ceremony in which Secretary Kathleen McGinty, as many of you know, will recognize commitments. Immediately after, Katie McGinty is done recognizing the commitments. If about half of the people at every table would stand up and move to another table and shuffle around. Got to do it quickly because we're on a tight time clock. But we'll see how it works, and if people like it, we'll do it again in the afternoon. So thanks, everybody. Have a great time.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists for renewable electric power. Vice President, Johnson & Johnson Corporate, Dr. Brenda S. Davis. CEO, Solar Century, Jeremy Leggett. Chairman and Managing Director, Suslin Energy, Tulsi R. Tunti. And our moderator, Principal, the Albright Group, the Honorable Carol Browner.
Good morning. Thank you all for joining us. I understand yesterday was a great set of conversations, and hopefully we can do that for you again today. We're going to be talking about renewable electric power, and what I want to do is pose a question to each of our panelists, ask them to respond briefly, and then we'll try and have a dialogue about this issue for you. Let me start with Brenda. Your company is one of the largest corporate purchasers of solar wind energy, I understand. You made a commitment to cut CO2 emissions 7%. Below 1990 levels is a dramatic commitment, and we congratulate you on that. I thought it might be interesting if you could share with the group how you make a decision like that in a large company. What role does the CEO play? What role does the board of directors play? How does that actually happen?
Sure. Thanks, Carol, and very nice to be here. Thanks for the invitation. We've actually exceeded our goal already. We set this goal to reduce CO2 emissions by 7%. Below 1990 levels in absolute terms, not indexed to sales. And as of the end of 2005, we've reduced emissions 11.5%, while our sales increased 350%. So we feel very good about that. The decision to do this, to take this position, is rooted in what we stand for as a corporation. We are the largest and most diversified human healthcare company in the world. And as a human healthcare company, we understand that the health of people depends on the health of the planet. And what greater risk or threat is there to human health and the health of the planet than climate change? And thus it was, at least in my mind, a pretty straight line from understanding that to going to our executive committee with a recommendation that we adopt a climate-friendly energy policy. We have a long history in Johnson & Johnson of very aggressive efforts towards energy efficiency with annualized savings of about $30 million a year around the world. That's been going on for a long time, but the big step forward occurred, actually began with an invitation from the World Wildlife Fund in 2000 to take a public stand on CO2 emissions reductions as part of their Climate Savers program, which we adopted, and we're one of the first two companies to partner with the World Wildlife Fund on that. And then that was followed, as I said, in 2003 by the adoption of a climate-friendly energy policy, which was approved by our executive committee. I presented that recommendation to the executive committee, including our chairman, vice chairman, and so on. They agreed to it, and we've been going after it hard ever since. It's a global policy. It applies in every country of the world, developed and developing, to every facility in the world. We actually have CO2 reduction pathways that have been developed for every single facility in the world within Johnson & Johnson that have an appropriate combination of techniques for that country and that manufacturing process or that office building that we believe will enable that facility to reach the target individually and us as a corporation to maintain that target collectively. It's tough, though, because we hope to continue to grow quickly. As all of you know, you've got to absorb all that growth.
Thank you, Brenda. And I guess what I hear you saying is it was a combination of leadership at the top, a partnership with an NGO that helped you think about this. And then what I found very interesting is this clear commitment and articulation of really a plan. And I assume that allows you to really measure the kind of progress that you're making.
Yes.
And it's a way of holding everyone in the company accountable to the commitment.
Yes, we're big on accountability. And we know precisely what CO2 emissions are occurring at every facility around the world and what the plans are to reduce those. We aren't foolish. I mean, some facilities have more opportunity than others, just like some countries and various places have more opportunities than others. So we actually have our own little internal cap and trade thing going on within business sectors, and we roll it up according to our three business sectors: pharmaceutical, medical devices, and consumer. Have very variable goals, but as a corporation, as I said, we are exceeding. We've reduced greenhouse gas emissions 11.5% in absolute terms below the 1990 level for the corporation.
Congratulations. Jeremy, let me go to you. As many of you know, Jeremy is really sort of one of the go-to people, if you will, in the world on solar. And I want to ask you what probably isn't a simple question, but let me pose it simply. Solar power, thermal or photovoltaic? Where are we headed? What makes sense?
Well, both. I mean, the thing about solar is it's nothing more and nothing less than a member of a family, and it's a big, broad family, renewables, plus efficiency. I mean, it's you have to do these things by mixing and matching and with efficiency. That said, I think solar photovoltaics is perhaps a particularly important member of the family. It's pretty much the only one at the moment that gives you electricity right where you need it, no moving parts, just something magical about this technology. When you see it working, well, you don't see it working. It just sits there absorbing photons. And I find it vaguely magical. Every time my inverter kicked on in the morning when I lived in our test home, and there was a good feeling about that. And at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is deeply cut greenhouse gas emissions. And in the UK, I think it's pretty much the same here in the States. More than half the emissions come directly and indirectly from buildings. Big and important as the transport sector is, this is really where we can take quick bites out of this enormous mountain. And from our own experience in Solar Century, we're a young company in a very small market, but the power of this technology is incredible. We can, with our partners, go out and put up a zero emissions building within weeks. Well, they're designed, they're ready to go, particularly if they're flat packed. We've done this with a mix of solar thermal, solar photovoltaic. Even if you take a manky old energy inefficient, they're not as inefficient as they are here in the States, but they're pretty inefficient. You take a typical British home, leaky as it is, and you've got 6 tons of carbon dioxide to wrestle with. You can lop off the first two in a matter of days with heating insulation and all those things. The third one, you can go out, I've done this myself with lights and appliances somewhat better than we have in this room. And you can go around and do that within a matter of weeks. And only then, you're halfway down and you haven't even started talking about electricity generation or energy supply, much less in big power plants. And then that fourth ton, and this I've done, well, just over half a ton myself with a 1.5 kilowatt roof that we put up on our first show home. And you know, you could have a ground source heat pump in the back garden, you could have a solar thermal, you could have a micro wind. You haven't even troubled large scale renewables, and you've done your 60% emissions reductions in half of the sector. And people, it's so frustrating when you work on the front line to know this and see the way we remain locked into these strange theocracies of fossil fuels.
That's not true in the United States, is it? Jeremy, let me ask you, we're seeing an increasing number of what we, I think, would call big players entering this field. BP, I think, made a major announcement in the last week. How do you see that changing things?
Well, it's thrilling. For an old hack like me, I've been, you know, banging my head against a brick wall for years. And over the last couple of years, maybe particularly the last 18 months, it's really taking off. And I see this in the boardroom. My day job is running what is now one of the fastest growing tech companies in the UK, which of course doesn't say much for the British economy. But my evening job is to, I work on a fund in Basel with a Swiss bank. It's the world's first renewable energy fund, and it sort of ticked over for the, founded in 2000, ticked over for a couple of years. Now it's very exciting, and of course that's a measure of serious money now focusing on this sector. It's a terribly exciting time, and you know, I really truly believe we can run the world on renewables and efficiency. We can do it much faster than most people think, including, I would say, the majority of energy pundits. And of course, we have a perfect storm of drivers brewing to help us do this, hopefully.
Thank you. Tanti, thank you for joining us. Now we have the go-to guy on wind energy. If I might ask you about, from your perspective, what would be the single or the several things that we should do to really accelerate the wind energy industry?
Thank you. The wind is very high potentialities are available in the globe market. The currently industries is highly matured and already commercialization phase has started. The technology has already matured and the large potentialities are available in the globe. If you see the year and year, last 3 years, the 40% growth is industries are growing. And technology development is more focusing and different current country-specific technology, because initial days the technology was highly concentrated in the Europe. But when now we are focusing, one side of the world is looking for the high growth and high energy requirement. Other side, the fossil fuels and the gas price is going in a high side. The third point is very serious, and that's why we are here today, is the climate change issues. So if we want to integrate all three problems in the one single remedies, the wind is the best source today is available for us, because the volume-wise and the huge opportunity on that reduction on the CO2 is possible, because each megawatt is giving 1,500 tons reduction in the CO2. Second is the very fast installation and modular industries are there. So we can install it very fast, and that's the growth potentialities are very, very high. But the key challenge today is to how to accelerate this growth. The major focus area is the maybe the developed countries are very strong awareness about the climate change issues, the fuel issues, and the increase in the energy price is going high, and the very high level of focus of the energy independence or energy security issue. But the same thing on the other part of the world, where the high energy need is increasing, that awareness is the strongly missing. So the key focus is required, the very strong awareness is required, so that they understand very strongly, because their growth is very high, their need of energy is high. And the very important thing is, this is not just climate change, is not a one country specific problem. It's a global issue and global problem. Why not it should be taken as a policy framework should be the global, rather than every country is in piecemeal. the different approaches are going on. Rather than then, if we can accelerate this growth, it's only possible if it should be the global agenda, and it should be a global mission, and the policy framework and the process should be established, and the very high strong focus should be the technology developments, because still this technology has a big room in the efficiency point of view. Most of the technologies are available in the certain types of the environments and certain types of the needs, but huge opportunities are available in the global. If we focus very strongly, the 30% of the energy can be possible from the wind, which world needs tomorrow, that can be achievable. And the way industries are growing is very, very less. Today, what is the wind contribution in our total grid is not more than 0.7%. So it's a very extremely low, where the potentiality and resources are very high. If I see the focus only, I will give the number of the U.S., 250,000 megawatt potentialities are available in the U.S. Huge land sites are available, and those land sites in the rural areas, where the social economy growths are very, very strong, potential is there. So if we can accelerate this process by way of the awareness, by way of the policy frameworks and technology initiatives, and the biggest constraint and bottleneck is the grid, infrastructure development, and long-term 5 years planning of the construction of the grid, if it is established, I feel the wind industry's growth can be possible very, very strong way. And by 2030, the globe can achieve 30%. And the best beauty of the wind power is that it's a directly 100% contributing in CO2 reduction very, very fast. So it is a very important tool or important resources. And God has given an excellent gift. I will tell you, 200,000 megawatt is wind is going today out of the U.S. Just 10,000 megawatt we are converting into energy. Assuming if we have a 200,000 megawatts oil is available in ground, how fast we are accelerating that resources? Why not we utilize wind very fast? Another things are that to extract the oil, huge energy and huge resources we are utilizing. To extract the wind, there is no resources and energies are required. Just conversion of the energy into electricity is the fastest way. It's a very, very strong growth opportunities there. By three process, I think wind become very good, strong resources for our world. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me follow up, Tante, on something that you talked about and get a little bit more specific for our audience, and that's the sort of the policy framework. As some of you can imagine, having run the EPA for 8 years, I'm a big fan of regulation and know a little bit about it. So what I'd like to ask our panelists is, what can the government do? If you could say today one thing, either from a global perspective or your individual country perspective, if the government could embrace sort of one policy, one directive, what would it be? What would be the single most important thing? Brenda?
Well, interestingly, in this venue, we're very supportive of regulation as well. And I guess if I had to say one thing, I'd use the old right-to-know approach and have every business report CO2 emissions. And I think I'd follow that in close order by mandatory caps on CO2 emissions. And I think in the absence of that, it's going to be very difficult even for companies like ours, because we've got to have government policy, global government policy, that puts economic value on greenhouse gas emissions and is backed up by caps and transparency about emissions. And so that's the position that we would take.
Jeremy?
Well, there's two ways of coming at the question. The big carbon question, of course, I agree exactly with what's been said. We've got to put a price on carbon. But for solar, I wonder if I could just sort of tell a quick anecdote about the type of dilemma that we face. When our Prime Minister was going to announce that climate change was going to be a big feature of the G8 summit before last, he chose our company to come and visit in the morning with the British press corps and a pack of sniffer dogs and a rather ferocious-looking superintendent from the anti-terrorist squad. But he wanted to sit down with 12 young people working in a green industry, and they asked him the question, this kind of question. Why, my head of project management said, Prime Minister, what's the single most important thing you can do? And without missing a beat, he said, we've got to lead from the front. We've got to put these wonderful technologies I've just seen, I paraphrase but accurately, on as many government buildings as we can. Well, 2 years later, I'm not going to tell you what the count is of those buildings. And this is my leadership is so important in this. And it would be so easy if we had a Churchill in a country like the UK. You know, we have a national security crisis, far bigger than the threat of terrorism, no matter really almost how bad that gets. Global warming is going to wash over our economies like a multitude of invading armies if we leave it unabated. If that isn't a national security crisis, I don't know what it is. And so given that half the emissions come from buildings, government could just say, we think we have a mandate here to require that no building be put up without efforts to address this. So you change the building codes. That's all you have to do. You could do it in a couple of weeks' worth of legislation if you use the kind of rhetoric that we hear, not backed by policy action.
Thank you. So we have a mandatory cap and trade. We have regulations on buildings. I assume that would be both new construction and retrofits. Tanti?
Yeah, as far as the wind resources, the policy issues, it should be a global policy rather than state or country policy because it's a global issues. And minimum 25% RPS, renewable portfolio standard, should be established across the globe so that we can utilize these resources as fast as possible. And it should be not just guideline or policy, but it should be a mandatory. So that is the prime one requirement is there. It's not only by the government we can expect the policy issue, but it's all the stakeholders, the industries, the financial institutes, and consumers has to set the targets, a minimum certain percentage in my consumptions, I will utilize the renewables. So that should be there. And the financial institute and banks, they set the target, the certain percentage of amount will be utilized and mobilized and invested in the renewables investment. So that should be the target should be set, and it should be a mandatory. And once we do that, and if we achieve, I am very confident by 2030, whatever the climate change issues, what we are suffering and what threat we are seeing, it can be converted into the good, better life for our societies. Thank you.
So we've now heard caps, buildings, and a 25% renewable portfolio standard. Over what period of time are you suggesting? And you're suggesting a global.
Yeah, global. And if we go aggressively and if it is a topmost priority by 2030, I am confident it is achievable by
2030. Let me take the idea of this renewable portfolio standard back to Brenda and Jeremy. Comments on that?
Well, we're currently at about 30% of our power purchases and production that from our own on-site projects, solar primarily, at 30% renewable. So we already have exceeded that in our own portfolio, but what we worry about is supply and what will drive and generate supply and at a competitive price, because it gets harder and harder to justify expenditures if it's way out of whack with what market pricing is. So tremendous interest in policies that drive increase in supply. We're on record publicly supporting a long-term production tax credit in the United States for renewable energy. We also have sent a letter of support to Governor Schwarzenegger on the pending bill, again, for reporting and caps on all businesses in California. All of those things will drive supply, and that's what we worry about. We've hit 30% now on renewables, but the competition hopefully will increase for that supply, and we'd like there to be enough for everybody.
Brenda, let me just ask a follow-up to that, and then I'll go to Jeremy. You're at 30%. Your global company. Has it been easier in some places
sure.
than others? And,
yeah.
and maybe just share one reason, what makes it easier somewhere?
Yeah, it's easier in the U.S. and Europe.
It is.
And in the U.S. where we've had the greatest success, we've actually set up a special fund in a very decentralized corporation where all capital comes out of our businesses. There's no capital managed by the parent, Johnson & Johnson. And for the first time ever, we are managing $40 million a year at the corporate level for investment in on-site cogeneration or renewable projects. And where we're able to do those is in states that provide incentives for investment in renewable technology, primarily solar. Then also in markets where regional markets in the U.S. or Europe where we can purchase renewable energy, we're doing that. Locking in long-term contracts to the extent that's possible, which sometimes it isn't. But the U.S. and Europe is where we've had the greatest luck in purchasing renewables. And again, as everybody's saying, we need to have access to renewable power globally.
Jeremy, 25% renewable,
yeah, well,
2030.
Of course, I'm a big fan of targets and portfolio standards. The one cautionary word about banding, I think one of the things we have to be careful to do in the interests of true diversity of supply is to encourage explosive growth in every member of the renewable family. And if you do it as a sort of bucket approach to portfolio standards, you can have casualties. And one of the troubles that we face in the solar industry is that we're constantly told, not just in the UK but other countries, well, that's too expensive, the payback's too long. And what people mean by that is that if you compare the capital cost against the price of electricity, you know, you're going to face a period of years getting it back. But there are other ways of looking at solar. It's a very high value material. Right now, with energy prices as they are in the UK, if you bung £10,000 into a building society, which most people do, to save, you'll get a return of X. If you put it into a solar roof installation with current building energy prices, you get a return of X plus. And nobody asks, you know, what the payback is in an investment in a building society. So we have to, you know, it's a marketing challenge. We have to make people realize this. And, of course, there are rapidly expanding niches where this supposedly expensive material is competing with decorative but functionalist building materials. It's a beautiful material in its own right. The payback is negative. And we just put six homes up on a housing estate with a volume house builder partner, six with solar roof tiles, six without, and of course the six with tiles sold like that. Because people said, you mean that's a power station? I could plug that into batteries if the world goes pear-shaped. That's making electricity, free electricity, with the way electricity prices. I'll have that, thank you very much. And, you know, so it's a value proposition, and that's the challenge for our industry. But we need some help from governments, and we're getting that in countries like Germany, states like California and Japan, but the rest of the world, not so much yet.
We have about a minute and a half left, so I want to ask one final question and maybe get a one-word or two-word answer. Climate change is obviously one of the biggest problems the world has ever faced. It is a global problem, but ultimately it requires action by companies, by individuals, by governments. Have we reached a tipping point in terms of the public's interest in this issue, and is the public going to drive its leaders to make the tough decisions in the short term?
I'll tell you from our perspective, I wish we had more public pressure. It doesn't feel like enough yet from share owners, and I think it has to translate, as I say, into government action. And so I like to think, yeah, but
I think we're
know.
Not quite there.
I don't know.
Jeremy, from your part of the world?
Well, I've been living in hopes on this ever since 1989 when I became a paid-up environmentalist. Yeah, I think there are reasons to be hopeful, but I'm not counting on it. Neither am I counting on governments in the modern world. I place a really major role for business leadership. I think there is tremendous potential here. And there, I do believe, we're beginning to see a tipping point and a real mega trend in the world at the moment.
And Tanti, from your part of the world.
Yeah, it's very important, and the public awareness, and if the mass motion is established, and they feel, you know, in my house I need a renewable energy, and that is giving the big drive, and the strong leadership can support this development is possible.
If you could please join me in thanking our panelists.
Thanks very much. That was great specific information. We now turn to the time in the program when you have a chance to talk at the tables about the kinds of topics that the panelists were just addressing. The first question that we're going to look at is, how can I actually use more renewable power? And I think Jeremy, for example, gave very specific questions of how he's done that in his own homes and the homes they build. But we want to push you to go even further around. How can you personally, or how can you and the companies that you run, use more renewable power? The second question is the policy question, is what are the most important steps that could be taken to promote the growth of renewable power? The chances here are if you to add the ideas that you'd like to add from the comments that came from all three of our panelists. Now, I wanted to take just 1 minute. We were told that there's a few tables, and I think a couple of them are right up front, that actually have only three or four people at them. So we would suggest collapsing tables where there's just three or four people, joining the same table, or grab an empty chair at a table next to you. So facilitators would help make that happen very quickly. That'll ensure that every table has a full set of members for participation. You have a half hour for the discussion. Enjoy. Okay, if you'd please bring your discussions to a conclusion and focus your attention back up on the stage. The panel will first respond to your questions. Okay, folks, this is the danger of letting them talk. All right, folks, can I have your attention, please? We want to give the panel the opportunity to respond to the questions that you put in earlier in the day. We know this conversation could go on for days and days, so we're going to ask you to pull it to a gentle close and come back to Carol and the panel. Thanks.
Okay. We have a number of thoughtful questions which were provided to us by all of you. What we'd like to do is maybe take three or four of them. We're going to start with a question for Brendan. Is Johnson & Johnson working with its suppliers to get them to cap their emissions? Has there been any shareholder pushback on your initiatives? Two different questions.
Well, on the second question on shareholder pushback, no. Not on, like, thinking we're going too far, none. But I would say there's shareholder nothing. It's shareholder quiet on climate change for us. So I think that's an important opportunity. Not that we want shareholder resolution.
I was going to say, you're not inviting it, are you?
if you send me a shareholder resolution, not a good idea. On suppliers. Yeah, we actively communicate with suppliers and encourage them to do the right thing and tell them why and offer technical assistance if they're willing to do it. But the problem is we have about 11,000 major suppliers and, you know, 1 to 2 zillion additional suppliers around the world. And for us to try to create and enforce a cap kind of program is simply not going to happen. So I drop back to my earlier answer, which is we need transparency in the system. We need every business to be part of the solution. We need every business to be reporting greenhouse gas emissions. We need thoughtful cap and trade systems around the world. We need better supply and access to renewable energy and greater incentives for efficiency.
Thank you. Jeremy, why don't we go to you next? When will unsubsidized photovoltaic power be competitive with power from fossil fuels?
Well, I kind of covered this, I guess, in part before the break, talking about the niche markets and how we're close to competitive in some of the high electricity price companies, countries even now. Manufacturing costs are coming down 10% a year, have been doing so for years. That's costs. Right now in the industry, we have a bit of a wrinkle because the demand has gone vertical and the feedstock suppliers can't keep up, or the industry generally can't keep up. It's kind of sad that we never worked out how to get enough infrastructure to melt sand, but there we are. That's true. So I guess the other dimension that I didn't talk about was what we compare against, because routinely we compare against the wholesale price of polluting power. So you give your client, whoever it is, a company or a consumer, a little Excel spreadsheet, and basically you're saying, here's a product that once you've paid the capital cost is going to give you free electricity for how long? Decades. You know, these products come warranted for 20 years now, and that is real manufacturer confidence. So fill in the square in your Excel spreadsheet. You know, what's the future price of electricity going to be? Now, in an earlier career, I was a creature of the oil industry. I worked on oil source rocks, actually, I'm ashamed to say, funded by BP and Shell. I'm a fully paid-up member of the Peak Oil Brigade, I have to tell you. I think energy prices are going to go through the roof on our watch, and I think that there are incredibly compelling arguments for that. So, you know, another challenge for our industry and people who sort of think strategically about this whole dreadful question, never mind about global warming, this is the mother and father of all drivers that will be irrefutable. We'll still have people like Fred Smith, you know, telling us that it's all natural variability even when the world is shriveling up. But with energy prices, there won't be any escape, and I think it's going to play out on our watch. And that Excel spreadsheet box should have a big number in it.
Thank you. And Tanti, one of the questions we got I think would be appropriate for you. How do we convince developing countries that renewable energy will provide adequate energy for economic growth?
Yeah, it's very important when we are talking a developed country and developing country. The developed country focuses how to control the cost of the energy. The challenge in the developing country, they need energy because their growth is very high, the demand is very high. So the two things are completely different scenarios are there. Some level, some extent, the developing country is already convinced, yes, this renewable it can be contribute in our economic growth very strongly, but it's not enough today. So the key issues for them is importance are there, how to accelerate and how to mobilize the investment in that direction. Because the need of the energies are increasing 14% by India and China, so it's a huge requirement is there. And how to utilize that? Nearly 70% of the energy they are importing from other countries, so they are highly unsecured also. So these are the issues are very clear. So for developing countries, very, very important. They have to focus very strongly on the renewables, but the challenge issues are there. The political will and the message should be goes to the industries, to the utilities, to the consumers, and to the infrastructure development issues, and the mobilization and investment, the fund resources are the key challenges there. But if you see, distinguish the India and China, but because that are the major countries in the high growth, like India is consuming 120,000 megawatt, and next 5 years they need 100,000 megawatt. China is consuming 380,000 megawatt, and they need 200,000 megawatt. But their access of the technologies are limited today. So if that should be available, and that's it, because it's a global issue, it's not a country-to-country issue. So access of the technology, and it should be the low-cost investment, and the financial institutes' supports for the investment on those, right, whether we invest in the developed country, whether we invest in the developing country, finally climate change are giving the same effect. So that is the very important things are there. And to mitigate this investment, because it's a huge capital investment issues are there. So there's some mechanism should be developed. Today we have a Kyoto Protocol, but it's not fully implemented. So new system should be, the global system should be established. And that will give the supports to the one part of the world, can support the other part of the world. Finally, it's give the benefit to the climate change. And that's directly giving all human life supports. So it's very, very important. Otherwise, the developing countries are consuming the fuels and coal and other things the way. It will damage the environment very strongly. And other sides of the developed country, we are seriously thinking about the climate change issues. But that rate and this rate, if you say here we are talking about the saving and economy issues, other side is a huge and large demand is there. And they want to grow and they will grow. So because of that, we have to understand and make us so balanced. And some mechanisms should be established so that direct, indirectly, it gives a very good benefit to the climate change issues very strongly.
Thank you. And I think now we're going to go to David to hear what you all had to say.
Thank you very much, Carol. Well, this morning we actually had a fair amount of rebellion against the first question. We had, somebody who said, this is not the important question. It's not about individual choice. It's about broader social policy. Somebody else who said it's marginal if we only look at the individual level. But recalling that the theme of this conference is what can I do, and that President Clinton has asked us to think about what can I do. We have answers to the question, what can I do? Complex fluorescence came up. This is hardwired into people's brains at this point. Everybody knows about compact fluorescence, and that came up from a lot of different tables. A lot of very interesting thoughts about creating corporate policy on purchasing renewables. Start by assessing what's possible. Every business should assign a person to focus on renewable energy. This is a theme that actually we heard yesterday too, kind of individual performance assessments on employees in this area. Partnering with knowledgeable NGOs came up in a lot of areas. And educating the public through advertising of companies who are interested in purchasing renewables. A fair amount on building awareness, lots of material there, demonstration projects, customer or employee reward programs, reporting on carbon footprints, for example, through on credit card statements, interesting idea, and a lottery to give away solar systems. And then I think another theme that came out here on the what can I do is in the cooperation area, definitely partnering with NGOs. Somebody suggested banding together in apartment buildings to implement building-wide measures. So on the question that people wanted to answer, which is one of the most important steps to promote the growth of clean renewable power, government policy clearly was the most important theme here. Mandatory regulatory schemes such as caps on emissions, tax policy, subsidizing renewables, green building standards, net metering laws. An interesting suggestion for a Manhattan project to develop energy storage technologies because some renewables have intermittency issues, and so energy storage technologies can be very important. Government purchases got a lot of attention. Education got a lot of attention. And financing, and that's something we're going to be talking about more this afternoon. Some of the quotes that were interesting, somebody said tax policy is the elephant in the room. Somebody said there's no limit to the capital available. The problem is the level of regulation to shape the market. And very succinctly, somebody said we need price, regulation, education, and business leadership. Thanks.
Thank you, and thank all of you. Very, very helpful. We have a few minutes left, and I want to give each of our panel participants a chance to make something of a closing statement. But if I might ask you the way this was presented to us, you all probably don't have these yet, is we have a page called Other Gems, which lists, as David said, tax policy, price, regulation, education. If I might ask the panelists to focus on that last page as you sum up your comments. And is tax policy the elephant in the room? Is it true that there's no limit to the capital? And share with us your point of view on that. Brenda.
Let's see. From the position of a corporation, I wouldn't say there's no limit to the capital. It's not...
Just to set the record straight.
Not
right?
A freebie. And, you know, saying when we get past the capital, then it's all free. Well, you have that nasty little problem of depreciation for years and years and years. So... I don't know if it's tax policy that's the elephant in the room. I think it's an opportunity. As I said, we've been supportive publicly of the long-term renewal of the production tax credit in the U.S. to support renewable power, and, you know, it certainly is a tool. I think, like a lot of things, public support, you know, which is two little words, but very hard to accomplish. Public understanding, public support is perhaps the most important thing. And I want to drop back to my shareholder comment a moment ago. I was thinking I actually spoke in error, because to the extent we have socially responsible investment funds owning Johnson & Johnson stock, and there are a lot of them that do, we do tend to make it into all of those portfolios. Those folks are very aware of what we're doing, review that with us at least annually, provide persistent constructive pressure to continue to do the right thing in the company on that front, and many, many others. So I think, again, though, that goes back to individual share owners and how they choose to invest their funds, and public education, public knowledge. And I just can't escape from this being one arena where there's a lot of opportunity for individual leadership by right-minded companies and people and so on, but it really does call for governmental action on a broad scale, and multilateral preferably.
Thank you. Jeremy?
Yeah, I think there's much to agree with, unsurprisingly, with the things that have come from the table. But perhaps one thing that's missing, in as I look back over the last couple of decades being involved in this, the elephant in the room is this human resistance to change. And this plugs in to the business leadership issue. If I can just sort of share some of the experience from my own country. We had in 2003 an energy white paper that involved multi-ministry, pan-industry consultation. There were over 60 companies across the entire sector that took part in this. And the outcome, many people here would have seen it or even read it, was, you know, quite visionary for government, and with seemingly major buy-in. And it said, you know, we're going to go for 60% cuts, admittedly, you know, by the time generations yet to be born are running a country. But we're going to do it with renewables and efficiency and low-carbon technologies other than nuclear. And then, all of a sudden, we're dealing with another energy paper just a few years later, which pretty much takes a reverse view and says that nuclear has a major role, even though the company that's going to be building these reactors itself says there's no way it can get them on stream until 2017. It's going to be game over by then. So what's produced that? And it is, I think, those of us who've studied it, seen it close to, that there are theocracies. There are fossil fuels and nuclear have massive vested interest theocracies, and it's sort of very difficult for us to overcome that. And this is why we need business leadership. And if I could single out one example, one of our clients is Gaisley, a property developer. They're wholly owned by Walmart. And what's happened in Walmart is just, I'm sure everyone here knows the story, so I won't dwell on it. When I first saw Lee Scott's speech from October last year, you know, with the epiphany speech where he says, we're going, guys, you know, global warming's real. We're going to show the spirit that we had in, I paraphrase again, that we showed in New Orleans. We're going to do it and go for zero emissions. And right now, we see this dealing with wholly owned subsidiaries of theirs who are clients of ours. And when I first saw that speech, I thought it was the kids up in the marketing department who'd been down in the pub the previous night. I know, we'll knock up this speech and we'll make him you know, all excited. And it was just on a word file, but it was the real thing. And, you know, we have more of that kind of stuff with real meaning, real traction. And unlike politicians who shall be nameless, who, you know, are good at rhetoric and then follow up with little or nothing. You know, in the business world, you say you're going to do something, generally you have to do it, and very often if you don't, you get fired. So, you know, I continue to live in cautious hope.
Thank you. Thank you.
The renewables is the key challenge, and when we are discussing about the policy, tax, and the capital, it has to go together, because it's very, very important for us to understand, because anywhere in the world or any country, the power sector is highly controlled and governed by the regulatory process. It's not a free market. It's not a free, because it's directly affecting the human life issues, and directly it is run and controlled by the political will. So its sector itself is so controlled and governed by the regulators and political will. So once this awareness at the common people level is there, maybe, but other side we have to understand the leadership level also, what way, in which direction our world has to go, because that is the key issues are there. And I very much appreciate this Clinton initiatives has a strong initiatives towards that, and take us a very serious steps on that. So to understand, the capitals are available in the market today. Huge capitals are there. People are ready to invest, but whether their investment safe and secured, and it's really converting the good returns for them. So that environment should be established, and regulatory frameworks are very, very important is there. If you see the history, some of the important things in a different country, they are playing with the renewables and not truly aggressively developing the certain issues are there. When they are realizing the certain cost issues, and now the fossil fuels and other prices gone very, very high. So suddenly this awareness has developed in last 2 years, we can say. But 2 years before, our market was not aggressive, and there was a turbine was available, tremendous turbine stocks was there. And today we are a certain situation, and supply chain is completely exhausted. And 2008 and 2008, all global production is sold out. So that change is came. Why? Because the fuel currency has gone high, and the economy is changing of the power cost and other issues. If you focus in the U.S. particularly, I want to share with you the tax issues. The production tax credit, it is indirectly giving the good momentum, but other side is a control also. So either it should be removed 100%, then it's also a good sense, then automatically the market mechanisms can support that, or it should be a very long-term policy, rather than every year, every 2 years we are changing. And this is the infrastructure projects. Because if you want to invest in the infrastructure and renewables, it's a 5 years planning. And somebody wants to invest in the development and infrastructure investment, the grid installation, other things, he has to do a long-term visibility of their investment. So capital is available, but visibility is not there. So that are the issues are there. So rather than PTC, we strongly recommend, if it is established, is TTC. It's a transferable tax credit. Because production tax credit is giving only to those who are paying the high income tax. Why it should be not available to the common people? So common people can invest in the wind power, and then huge momentum will come, and that will give the big drive. And TTC is the right option, transferable tax credit, but it is a link with the production. So that's in, that way momentum can be established. So the focus is the leadership, and regulators is the key issue to drive the renewables in the power sector, and that will give the very good impact in the climate change issues. That's my submission.
Thank you. Let me ask a question about other renewables. We've been focused here today really on wind and solar. What are the other opportunities out there? I think, Brenda, you got some other things online.
Yeah, we're supporting projects that have good returns on investment and from any renewable avenue we can find. So for example, we have one geothermal installation in France, a biomass project in Schaffhausen, Switzerland, that is actually using wood chips from a sustainably managed forest that the local community actually uses. This was just waste product and generating power from that, completely replaced, if I remember correctly, purchases of electricity off the grid with this biomass. And then landfill gas. We have in Silicon Valley, we have the Alza pharmaceutical company, and worked out an arrangement with the municipality. This was a cap, different kind of cap, landfill, generating methane gas by the truckloads, which of course is a terrible greenhouse gas. And we now pipe all of that methane into turbines and generators in our facilities, and 85% of the power for that company, Johnson & Johnson is actually 200 companies, 85% of the power of that company is coming from that methane, the landfill gas. So, you know, we're open to all of these possibilities, and some of them actually are extremely attractive from a financial perspective.
Jeremy, anything you want to add to the list of opportunities?
Yeah, well, I love them all the renewable technologies, and I think, sadly, our industry has suffered a little bit too much from people who are particularly enthusiastic about their own sector, you know, bad-mouthing other sectors. I'd go further. I mean, I'm pretty much a bit of a zealot, but, I mean, just fossil fuels have their place in the load matching with renewables, absolutely. And in the UK, we have a wonderful exemplar of how you can use fossil fuels and renewables together in the borough of Woking, where there are gas CHP plants that are hooked up with big solar. About a quarter of the country's solar is in this one borough. And you get perfect load matching, heating in winter, low solar electricity, no heating needed in the summer, high solar electricity. They are connected to the grid, but the grid's not used at all, not needed to. They're microgrids, essentially. So, you know, it's just innovation. It's mixing and matching. You mentioned load intermittency earlier on. You know, by mixing and matching the renewables, you can overcome loads of those problems. Really encouraging studies done recently at Oxford University on this. So it's important to take a holistic view, obviously.
Do we miss anything, Tanti?
Yeah, other renewables, we have so many cities in our the country and in the globes. The municipal waste will be converted into good energy, so that is the one of the source is good opportunity. And another area is the tidal waves can be utilized, because that energy is can contribute is very strongly. So that is the another renewables can be there. It's a more on experimental stage, and some developments are going on, but that's another next generation of the energy is there. Another most important, what we feel, rather than individual energy of renewables, it should be a mix, like the hybrid concepts, solar and wind, because the wind infrastructures are utilized only for 30%, because maximum plant load factor is 30% of the wind. All the infrastructures are available, and it's nearly 20% on the capital investment of the total project cost. So that can be commonly utilized for the solar. So solar and wind. Another good combination is possible is the gas and the wind, because that is the giving a very good combination is that. One of the good projects we are doing in Australia gas and light projects, they have 150 megawatt is a gas-based power plant, and 150 megawatt projects we are doing out of that 50 is already running, and 95 megawatts we are installing in Australia. So that both the source will be integrated, and that hybrid will give the very good benefit to optimization of the resources and optimization of the infrastructure. So that is the another combinations can give, because ultimately we have to use each and every source of energy the way need is increasing, and the way we want to reduce the CO2. It's the best combinations can give the more efficient energy optimization and resource utilization will be very strong.
Let me make an observation as the moderator, and thank all of you. I am struck as we talk about this, and as we talk about all of the tools we need to bring to bear to address the problem of climate change, the ways in which history can guide us, and if, particularly in the United States, but it's true world over, the scheme that we have developed over the last 30 or 40 years to address air pollution problems, to address water pollution problems, it really, I think, is a scheme that serves as well as we think about this. We have clearly used science. I think it is fair to say there is more than enough science to tell the world that it's time to do something. We have used regulation. Appreciated the comments on predictability. It's important to say to those who are going to be regulated, here is what is expected of you, here is the time frame. I personally believe you are far better in setting a much tougher requirement and perhaps providing some more time, but certainly that kind of clarity, that kind of predictability. I also think it's important to understand the role of enforcement. There's a fairness issue. If I'm a business owner, and we've learned this over and over again, and I make an investment to improve my facility to meet a regulatory requirement, I should know that anybody who I compete with who hasn't made this similar investment will be held accountable. And then the final thing we've learned, and I think each of the panelists spoke to it this morning, is leadership. and leadership in the business sector. You know, again and again, we were able to set tough pollution standards in this country because there were business leaders prepared to stand up and say, yes, you know what, we can do there. We may not know precisely how we can get there today, but we can get there. We can find the solutions. We can push the limits. And ultimately, leaders, and I think it's probably true both in the private sector and in government, are driven by the people. And so the idea of engaging the public by providing information, and I think in some ways that was one of my favorite comments I heard today, and we heard it in various ways from each of the panelists, which is the public really does have a right to know. They have a right to access information about what is happening. Thank you all very much for your insights, and thank you all for joining us.
Ladies and gentlemen, to recognize commitments in energy and climate change, please welcome Secretary of Environment of the State of Pennsylvania, the Honorable Kathleen McGinty.
Join me, if you will, in recognizing what was a fabulous, fabulous panel here. Panelists and Carol, thank you very, very much. Now, none of you need to comment on this, but I personally am signing up to lead Brenda Davis's campaign for president. 3 cheers for that. Well, thank you all again for your participation yesterday and joining us again today. As yesterday, we have some fabulous commitments to recognize today in leadership and inspiration. And while I don't mind if there's chatter while I'm speaking, I would ask the conversation to go in the hall so that our awardees can properly be recognized. Thank you very much. Let me start by inviting up to the podium a person who's been a terrific leader in solar energy as well as a personal friend of mine, Bob Freeling, from the Solar Electric Light Fund. And as I welcome Bob, let me describe to you a little bit of his project. Bob is continuing on a long line lifetime of service in deploying distributed solar energy systems. Specifically here, he will be investing $500,000 in a first round to build a series of solar water irrigation projects in the Kalali district of Benin. After the first pilots, they will extend the program to the entire district of Benin, which is some 44 villages. And let me just underscore, in terms of Bob's leadership and this project, several things that are really terrific about it. First of all, while all of us talk about the phrase the environment and the economy, this project really demonstrates how this focus on the environment is a huge economic opportunity, because the growing season for these villages, which now is 6 months, with the solar water pumping technologies, they now will be able to grow crops the year round through the dry season as well. That's terrific. And the second thing, the Solar Electric Light Fund is usually referred to as SELF. And following Carol Browner's comments, focusing on engaging the public, one of the things I want to commend Bob and SELF for, every project they do, before they do it, they have a hard and fast commitment that the local people in the village will learn, will operate, will run, will maintain that project. Hugely important, because too many people come, do the photo op, leave, and a year later it doesn't work and it's nice public art. But it's not an energy system. With Bob's projects, they are energy systems. Bob Freeling, ladies and gentlemen.
I'd like to also ask, if it's okay, Senator Ricardo Melchior from the Tenerife Island government to join me on stage. Just yesterday, Senator Melchior has pledged his support for this project, so I'm very grateful, and we're looking forward to a very successful cooperation.
Great.
Thanks, Bob and team. Let me also now welcome to the stage someone who is near and dear to many of us and has been a terrific, not only visionary, but can do in the business world, in Ray Anderson. We all do know Ray, chairman and founder of Interface. Today, having been a leader in reducing the use of toxic chemicals, a leader in insisting on recycling of his products, now he's taking on climate, and as always, not in a small way, but in a very robust way, Ray announces that Interface by 2020 will be completely carbon neutral. And as you would expect, Ray doesn't wait for the ceremony to get started. So this commitment actually builds on what is already a 35% reduction in the carbon footprint of Interface. And as always, it is a comprehensive commitment where they are looking at manufacturing, transportation, showrooms, and the offices where their carpeting materials are deployed and used so beautifully and attractively in those offices. So comprehensive. Just one other item of note, one of the big pieces of Ray's initiative to date. Brenda mentioned landfill gas opportunities. Ray has already built with a community in Georgia a showcase landfill gas project, which is cleaning up a pollutant while providing a very cost-effective energy resource. So, Ray, once again, your leadership is exemplary, and it's our honor to recognize you today. Building on that energy leadership, I wanted to recognize George Landiger, if he would join us, and he is with Parsons and Whitmore Enterprises. George proposes to build and invest $15 million to build a 40 million gallon per year soy diesel facility in Alabama. And I think there's a few things about this that are especially noteworthy. Obviously, taking the discussion about biofuels and making it a reality, building those plants, putting people to work. But I'll just express a personal experience in Pennsylvania. Soil sequestration is a big part of the climate equation, and that means we need to keep farmers on the land, farmland preservation, preserving open space. We have what's considered the biggest farmland preservation program in the country, but with that, we lose 3 acres of farmland for every acre we succeed in preserving. Now, that's the best record going in the country. It's not good enough. What George is doing is saying we have to give our farmers additional profitable business enterprises. Soy diesel is an excellent example of that. George, come on up. We thank you for your leadership.
Working on the climate issue for many
like Ray Anderson, not a person just to talk about things but to get them done, that she is launching an initiative now to secure approval of five programmatic CDM initiatives. Last, in welcoming her up to the podium, I wanted to underscore that she's focusing on energy efficiency initiatives, and I think we all agree, the cleanest, cheapest electron, as Amory would say, the negawatt is the electron we should go after first in taking on the climate challenge. So, Christiana, please join us.
Thank you, Katie.
Okay, now David said earlier, are we doing the change the tables now, or are we going to play a little music so everyone can go to a different table and we turn the music off, you have to sit?
Well, we do have a suggestion for how to do it, just to make it a little easier.
There you go. Thank you
okay.
all.
Which is, if you just think about your table, yeah, great job. Great job. If just as a quick little process. Thank you. If you take these two rows of tables and these two rows of tables, just across each pair of tables, about half of your shift. Down the middle, do that with the table right behind you. Those of you who don't want to shift, don't have to, but David got a lot of requests about this. Let me say one other thing before you start to move. Table facilitators, you need to change to the second subset topic on your computers to be ready for the input. Okay, thanks. Just quickly make a few shifts here.
Tell Kara, ask